Have you ever wondered what it would be like to meet God? You wonder what it would like to meet God, to have an unmistakable, tangible, and visible encounter with God? It's an intriguing question. When I was growing up, one of the popular songs on the radio was titled "What If God Was One of Us" by Joan Osborne, and it featured these lyrics. It said, "If God had a name, what would it be? And would you call it to his face if you were faced with all his glory? If God had a face, what would it look like? And would you want to see if seeing meant that you would have to believe in things like heaven and in Jesus and the saints and all the prophets?" If you know that song, you know it. And if you don't, my condolences that you've missed out on defining moments of the 90s. In any case, the song is drawing on the question, what would it be like to have an unmistakable, visible, tangible encounter with God? What would it be like to actually meet him? TV and movies have also explored this kind of theme, haven't they? Over the years, we have seen movies that are mostly flippant and mostly tainted with a good deal of folklore rather than biblical truth about who God is and what it would be like to meet him. We have productions like Touched by an Angel, we've got Bruce Almighty, you've got Evan Almighty, and now most recently there's a TV series called God Friended Me. Right? All of them are exploring the kind of question that we're asking this morning. What would it be like to meet God? And the Bible is not silent on that question. The Bible, in fact, in these verses in Exodus, go a long way to answering that question of what it would be like to actually meet God, to have an unmistakable and tangible and visible encounter with God. And one of the things we learn from this passage is this, is that God reveals himself. God reveals himself. Verse 1 and 2 reads like this: "Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him." Don't miss that. It may not be the most staggering thing that's about this passage to you, but could I suggest to you that the Lord who makes himself known, the God who makes himself known, should rank really highly on the things that you appreciate about God. That he makes himself known. I mean, just think about this for a moment. If God never showed himself, never revealed himself, never disclosed or defined anything about himself, if he never produced this book we call the Bible, if he never articulated himself to humanity, how could we know anything about God? How could we know anything about God at all? Famous theologian Louis Burkhoff wrote this. He says, "Without revelation, that's without God revealing himself, man would never have been able to acquire any knowledge of God." He goes on to say, "In the study of all other sciences, man places himself above the object of his investigation. But in theology, that's the study of God, he does not stand above, but rather under the object of his knowledge. In other words, man can know God only insofar as the latter, that is God, actively makes himself known." And that's the point of verse 2, that God actively makes himself known to Moses. And so that has a really strong implication for us, students of the scriptures and people who want to know God. When Christians talk about who God is, or what their knowledge of God is, it should be based on what God actually reveals about himself. In plainer terms, our conception as Christians about who God is not based on TV and movies and pop songs or our imaginations or our feelings or books like The Shack, but from the Bible, where God has clearly made himself known. Right? We go to the source where God has revealed himself clearly. Why do we do this? Why do we go back to knowing God as he has revealed himself? Why is that important? Why can't we just make God up the way we want him to be? Like, why can't we just imagine God being a particular way and then that's the way God is? We can't do that because God himself puts a premium on being known and interacted with for who he is rather than who he is not. Right? God puts a premium on being known for who he really is. Let's take a closer look at verses 2 through to 6. They read like this. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight. Why the bush is not burned? And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take off sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now, this is probably as good a time as any to talk about this person we meet in this text called the angel of the Lord. Who is the angel of the Lord? The angel of the Lord is a figure who appears in the Old Testament over 60 times, and he often appears as a messenger of God, a messenger of God. But the Old Testament seems deliberately ambiguous about his true identity. Right? It interlocks his identity with God himself. So, note this. And particularly in this passage, it's also ambiguous that the angel appears as the fire in the bush, right? The angel appears as the fire in the bush. But the angel is then also called in this passage God, who spoke to Moses out of the bush. So the angel is in the bush, but it's God who speaks out of the bush. So we rightly ask, is the angel then actually God? Like, why beat around the bush? Sorry for the pun. But is the angel actually God? And at this stage of biblical revelation, we aren't given a direct answer, but God gives us clues that leads us to an answer. There is a figure called the angel of the Lord. We will encounter him again in Exodus as we go along. But this angel of the Lord is one who is identical to God. So much so that the author can simply interchange their pronoun, right? First it's the angel of the Lord in the bush, and then it's God in the bush. They're interchangeable. They are synonymous with one another. But the messenger, this angel of the Lord, being identical to God, is yet distinct from God and able to be present with humanity. And this is the key to it. Scholar Alec Motier, he concludes this way about the identity of the angel of the Lord. He says, there is only one other in the Bible who is both identical with and yet distinct from the Lord, able to accommodate himself to the company of sinners. Such indeed is the angel of the Lord as revealed in the Old Testament, who can be appreciated only when understood as the pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. That is to say, Jesus is the one who actually and ultimately fulfills what we learn about this dual identity of the angel of the Lord. He is one who is identified as God and yet in some way distinguishable. And Jesus takes up and fulfills what we learn about this angel of the Lord this way. He is both God and yet in some way distinguishable as God the Son. Right? Knowing this, we come back to our main question. What would it be like to meet God? What would it be like to meet God? And what we learn from Moses' unmistakable, tangible, and visible encounter is this. Meeting God is not like catching up with your friend for a beer or a coffee. It's just not that kind of experience where you're just casually hanging out. See, Moses wasn't just hanging out and chillaxing with his buddy God, who resembled a docile old guy with the voice of Morgan Freeman. I mean, that's just not God, right? Moses' encounter with God leaves him deeply moved and unsettled by his experience. He is so deeply moved and unsettled that he hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And time again in the Bible, when you see people who actually meet God, they are terrified. They are terrified people. They say things, oh, woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. They are terrified by the sheer reality of God, so close and upfront and personal. But why the fear? Why do people who actually get to see God this way in the Bible, why do they buckle over in fear? Why fear? What is it about God that made Moses so afraid to look? The answer has to do with the disparity between God's nature and Moses' nature, right? As a human being encountering the reality of God, there's a disparity there, right? Between who you are as a person and who God is. And we see this disparity represented by fire. Fire, we learn in the Bible, is representative of God's holy nature. Like God often reveals himself through fire to communicate something about his own holy nature. And Moses, as well as us, have to learn that God's holiness poses a danger to all that is not. Right? That is the big issue. That's what makes Moses so afraid. He's not like God, and he knows that God is just tremendously holy, and he is not. And that terrifies him. And that's a good and a right response to have. Again, Mortier, he notes this. He says, in a word, there is that in the nature of God which banishes and endangers sinners. Holiness endangers a sinner because the holiness of the Lord is not a passive attribute, but an active force embracing all that conforms to it and destroying all that offends. That's God's nature. To embrace all that conforms to him and destroying all that offends. And that's what should terrify us about God. So Moses has this problem. On the one hand, he feels drawn to God, like he does want to go and see the burning bush, right? It's attractive to him. He wants to know who this God is that appears this way. And yet at the same time, if he goes, he's immediately endangered. He wants to see, but if he sees, he's going to die. He's going to be consumed. So how would this stalemate be resolved? How could you overcome this massive disparity between God and humanity? God gives Moses two commands. It's by way of command. Two commands. He says, do not come near, first command. And then he says, take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Now, God does not tell Moses to take off his sandals because God's not into sandals. Like, that's not the issue here. The footwear is not the problem. The question is, will Moses obey? Will he do as God says? Or will he just do his own thing? That's the question here. And this is fundamental to how Moses was to understand this God whom he's meeting in an unmistakable, tangible, and visible way. As the living and true God, God has the right to command with the expectation of our obedience. Right? If he is the true and living God, he has the right, he has the prerogative to command whatever he wills and wishes with the expectation that we would obey. Because he's God. He gets to do that. He doesn't have to consult a manual. He doesn't have to turn to a book in heaven that says, how am I supposed to be God? What am I allowed to do? He does whatever he pleases with the expectation that we would conform. So at this point, Moses must either obey or be consumed. And I think this is very well committing to mind and memory. Because Jesus himself taught us that a life-giving, a fruitful, a rightly ordered relationship with God is irreducibly connected with our obedience. Like, you just can't have a life-giving and fruitful and a rightly ordered relationship with God if you're constantly walking in disobedience to him. You can't do it. Jesus said it this way, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Commandment keeping is a way to life and to fruitful, life-giving relationship with God. And certainly no less was expected of Moses at this point. Don't come any closer and take off your sandals. You have to obey Moses or you're going to be consumed. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. I want you to pay careful attention to the ordering of these events. Pay very close attention to the order of these events. First, God appeared to Moses. Then God calls Moses by name, and only then does God give Moses commands to obey. The order is absolutely crucial in the Bible. It is crucial because if we tinker with this, say we just reverse the order as a way to meeting God and to rightly knowing God. By our obedience, we try to make God appear like a genie, right? Like our obedience is like a hand rubbing a lamp, hoping that the genie God would appear to us if we do it just right. Rather than our obedience flowing from the fact that God has made himself known to us and called us by name, we lose the heart of the gospel. We lose the gospel if we reverse the order of these events. If we obey in order to make God appear to us. Instead, the Bible is tenacious about this issue, that our obedience always flows from having encountered God. That the right kind of obedience is the obedience which flows from a glad-hearted response to the good news that God has taken the initiative to seek us out and to call us by name. That's the kind of obedience that matters. Has God made himself known to you? Has he called you by name? And does that make you glad to obey him? See, the question that Christians ask is not, should I obey God? Of course we should obey God. The question that Christians ask is, why? Why do I obey God? Is it as a response to his kindness toward me? Or is it in order that I might earn his kindness toward me? And the way that you answer that question reveals whether you understand the gospel or not. Is your obedience geared to earning something from God, or is your obedience as a response, a glad-hearted response, because God is already for you and already called you by name? And lastly, I also want to show us, when Moses met God, God reveals his heart, if I can speak so anthropomorphically about God. God reveals his heart, right? What he's like, what captivates him. Though God is a consuming fire, he is also a God who is drawn toward rescuing the enslaved. God is drawn towards that kind of mission, to rescue the enslaved. Look at verses 7 through to 8. God says this, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. This tells us that there is something about being enslaved that provokes God. It triggers his intervention. Israel, Moses' ethnic family, had been subjected to decades of enslavement by this time. It included hard labor, oppression, and sporadic genocide in Egypt. And God says, I am not putting up with that. I have come down to deliver those people. You know, as the series rolls on, we'll come to see how God rescues this enslaved people in this particular time in history. But the idea of God's people, Israel, enslaved and oppressed by Egypt, also works metaphorically for all God's people enslaved under the oppression of sin and death. In the episode of the Exodus, God is illustrating the gospel to us. He is showing us in visible form what he does in and through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Where a liberator must be commissioned and sent to rescue God's people, at the same time defeating the oppressor. Right? The liberator must come, and he must also defeat the oppressor. And this is precisely what Jesus ultimately fulfills. We'll see this in more detail as we go on. But for now, just know that Jesus is the true and better Moses, commissioned and sent to rescue us from the slavery of sin and death. While at the same time, this Jesus will also defeat sin and death. Jesus drew this very point when he said to the Jews who had believed in him, he said, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And they answered, we are the offspring of Abraham. We have never been enslaved to anyone, meaning that we're not the Egyptian generation. We've never been enslaved, Jesus. What are you talking about? How is it that you say we will become free? And Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. And the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. And so Jesus just lays it out. He says, you may not have been the Egyptian generation, but you are a slave. if you commit sin. And you need a liberator. You need someone to set you free. And Jesus says, I am that person. I am the liberator who will set you free from your true slavery of sin. And of course, in the course of liberating his people this way, of setting them free, he also defeats the enslaving power that is at work against Christians. Further on in the Bible, in one of my favorite passages, it says to us this, that, and you who were dead in your trespasses, God made alive together with him, that's Jesus, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. Now check this out. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and the authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. God defeats the whole system of sin and death, and he triumphs over them. This is who God reveals himself to be. To Moses and to us. He is the holy, consuming God with an unquenchable pursuit of liberating his people. Those are the two things we learn from these first 12 verses. Let me pray for us.